Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Sambula vinaka oni varoronga tio mai ongo ena non da program wo sa mai tavodi na radio viti waira rapa ena biau live liva ero fm excess waira rapa io san vul karua puindi vitu fama ena ken vavalangi ero fm excess radio waira rapa 92.7 FM. Nisambula vinaka ni mata vinaka mai. Today we will listen to a special guest, Sue Barker, director of Sue Barker Charities Law in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I will just read a brief on Miss Sue Barker's bio to give us a backstory on what she does with regards to charities law in New Zealand. And the dialogue Sue Barker and myself will have today, she will help us understand what the taxation law for charities or non-profit organization means in the new upcoming proposed changes. Before I give you a backdrop to Ms. Sue Barker's bio, I would like to just revisit a statement on charity tax setting released from Cabinet on 24th February 2025 by Honourable Nicola Willis and Honourable Simon Watts on the header, Consultation on Charity Tax Settings Open. Consultation on an Inland Revenue Issues paper on the taxation of charity and not-for-profits opens today. Finance Minister Nicola Willis says the government is committed to a strong charity and not-for-profit sector, as well as high levels of fairness and integrity in New Zealand's tax rules. New Zealand not-for-profits make a significant contribution to the community, and the government provides tax relief for not-for-profit organizations that meet certain requirements. It is important the public has confidence that they are getting value for money from these tax concessions. Revenue Minister Simon Watts says the issues paper canvasses options to simplify rules, reduce compliance costs, and address tax integrity risks. It's important we make sure the settings are right and fit for purpose. No decisions have been made, and all feedback will be considered. The discussion document discusses and seeks public submissions on charity business, income tax exemption, donor-controlled charities and integrity and simplification. The consultation document can be found in the Cabinet website, and it has a link. Consultation closes on 31st March 2025. So now we'll move on to just hear a bit about Miss Subaka, who is the Director, LLB Honours, First Class, BCA and CA. Subaka is the Director of Subaka Charities Law Boutique Law Firm based in Wellington, New Zealand, specialising in charities law and public tax law. Since its founding in 2012, the law firm has won a number of awards, including Boutique Law Firm of the Year at the New Zealand Law Awards. In 2019, Sue was honoured to be awarded the prestigious New Zealand Law Foundation International Research Fellowship, Te Karahipi Rangahau Ati Tai Ao, New Zealand's premier legal research award, to undertake research into question, what does a world-leading framework of charities law look like? The report from the fellowship, Focus on Purpose, was released in April 2022, making 70 recommendations for charities law reform in Aotearoa, New Zealand. More information about the research, including a link to the report and a facility to sign up for updates, can be found at www.charitieslawreform.nz. Sue is recognized internationally as a charity law scholar by the International Charity Law Network and is a director of the Charity Law Association of Australia and New Zealand, a member of Charity Services Sector Group, and a member of the Core Reference Group for the Review of the Charities Act. Sue is also a co-author of the text, The Law and Practice of Charities in Aotearoa, New Zealand, LexisNexis 2024, and a contributor to Charity Law, Exploring the Concept of Public Benefit, Routledge 2022. You can read more of Sue's work in the website www.lawnewzealand.co.nz. Sue has been a regular guest lecturer at the University of Otago's Laws 486 Charity Law Not-for-Profit Law Summer Course and an invited speaker at the University of Melbourne Law School Master's Course Charity Law for 21st Century and the University of Auckland LLM Course. Sue has also been a visiting fellow at the University of Western Australia Law School. In 2015, Sue was made an honorary National Life Member of National Council of Women of New Zealand Incorporated, Te Kauhinera Wahine o Aotearoa, for her work assisting the council with charities law issues. Nisambula Vinaka, Ms. Subaka, thank you for accepting the invitation for us to have this korero or dialogue on air with regards to the new proposal for taxation on non-profit organization. We invite you to unpack for us some of the work you're doing, some of the details that those of us lay people can understand and get a grip of the impact of these proposed changes that is coming up in regards to taxing non-profit organizations. Vinaka.
Awesome. Well, as you know, the issues paper was released on 24 February and it gives charities until the 31st of March, which is a very short consultation period of just over 4 weeks to make submissions. My understanding is that deadline is a hard deadline. IRD will not shift it because they are wanting to make announcements about tax changes for charities on Budget Day, which is the 22nd of May. And of course, there's a process to go through of putting papers up to Cabinet and getting Cabinet approval, etc. So this paper represents probably the biggest set of changes proposed for the tax settings for charities for almost a century. So it is very important, in my view, that charities do engage with the process and make a submission. We need to. It's important that charities have their voices heard. So it's been kind of cobbled together. It's very light on detail, actual detail of what is proposed. So we don't know exactly what is proposed. And the issue is, I think, that the Chapter 2 of the paper proposes to tax business income of charities in some way. And I've spoken to a lot of charities who are saying, you know, that's where we want to move to. We want to run businesses to generate funds for our charitable purposes because that's the only way to go. You know, the donations are under pressure, government funding's under pressure, philanthropic funding's under pressure. We want to be able to stand on our own 2 feet and raise our own money. And this proposal is aimed at the larger charity, but who knows if that's where it would stay. And the underlying principle is that the business income should be taxed in some way. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you. I did see the brief that you sent out. I had a glimpse of it. Is that a model, a template that we can follow, or what is it? Because it's so technically yes. written. What do we do?
Well, I wouldn't recommend doing a template submission. It's not designed as a template submission.
Oh.
And my understanding is that if you do a template submission, certainly Parliament, I haven't heard IRD say this, but I suspect that they may treat them all as just one submission. So effectively, it would be, it may not have the impact that it deserves. So I would encourage charities to make their own submission. Minister of Finance has asked charities to let her know how these proposals would impact them individually, because that has been missing from the analysis to date. So, it would be preferable. It can be short. It can be one or two pages. It doesn't have to be a long submission. But it is important that charities have to...
We're so used for a long time here in New Zealand, seeing that non-profit do not get taxed. Businesses, commercial businesses get taxed. What are we seeing here?
Well, what the proposal is, there's four chapters. It's quite a short document, but there's four chapters. Chapter 2 proposes to tax the business income of charities in some way. So that's the basic ballpark. And they have various suggestions about how they might go about doing that. One of the suggestions they make is that they would tax what's known as unrelated. Now, this term doesn't make sense in charities law terms, but what they're arguing is that if your charitable purposes, say, the advancement of health or the promotion of health, and if you run a business that's a hospital, that business would be related to your charitable purposes. But if your charitable purposes were the promotion of health and you ran a dairy farm to raise funds for your charitable purpose, they would argue that that is unrelated. Now, if that sounds confusing, it's because it is. There is no distinction in principle between a business that is related or unrelated to a charity's charitable purposes, because in law, every activity that a charity makes must be made in the best interests of its charitable purposes. That's the charity's law concept that I think has been missed in this paper. There's a lot of assumptions in this paper that I think really do require critical analysis. So anyway, the other countries, some other countries do it. And they're saying that there's lots of international precedents for us to follow. But the problem is the fact that other countries do it, like the US, the UK, England, Wales, other jurisdictions in the UK, they do make a distinction between related and unrelated business, or in the UK it's called primary or non-primary purpose trading. But in practice, it doesn't work because there is no bright line. And we end up making a lot of work for lawyers and accountants and the courts as charities argue which side of this arbitrary line a business might fall. For example, if you have a church hall that rents out its hall for dance classes, is that related to its charitable purposes? It will throw up all of these issues for which there is no answer. And the paper argues that, well, we'll just have to make it clear in guidance. But the point I think that's missing is that it will not be possible to make it clear because it's not clear. There is no, it's conceptually not clear. So I think it would be a huge mistake for New Zealand to go down this rabbit hole.
Wow, it sounds, I'm quite curious about how the other countries that do it, like you said, US, UK, and other jurisdictions, would they're big countries with millions of people. There's only 5 million in New Zealand. And compare number of charities as to that, and then you start separating depending on tiers. How many are sitting at the tier 1, tier 2, tier 3 that may suffer the first impact of this tax?
Yes, well, they're aiming to target it at tier 1 and 2 charities running unrelated businesses. So they don't know how many would be impacted. They estimate in the paper maybe about 1,300 charities. And tier 2 is now annual expenditure of $5 million. So they are targeting the bigger charities. But the problem, though, is that thresholds can be changed. Mm-hmm. And if we have that line, that once your expenditure hits 5 million, you're going to be hit with this unrelated business income tax, that creates a disincentive for charities
to move up.
And the fundamental issue with it is that it's based on assumptions that don't hold. So we are addressing a problem that's not been identified properly with complicated solutions that in practice don't work. So I do think it's conceptually a mistake.
This is probably an unrelated question in regards to bulk funding. You know, some of these organizations are bulk funded by government themselves. Yeah. Would they be taxed in the funding that they get given, or is it the outcome of those funding when they do businesses?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, there is a section in the issues paper that talks about issues that will be thrown up, and that's one of the issues. What is a business? What constitutes a business? We'll have arguments about that. Is it regularly carried on? That's been a big area of uncertainty in the United States. Is it related or unrelated? So for charities who we really want focused on their charitable purposes, we will be distracting them with these time-consuming and unproductive arguments over whether they fit within this arbitrary category. So in my view, you know, the government should go down this route at their peril.
Wow. You know, you mentioned about United States. Just to diverge a bit, the US president has seized or suspended all the US aid. Does that come into any sort of scenarios we're seeing here in a small scale?
Well, I think it's a very concerning development what's happening in the United States, which perhaps should also give us cause for pause before we follow the United States approach to charities running businesses. And, you know, one other aspect of this debate is that a charity running a business is by definition a social enterprise. Mm-hmm. And social enterprise didn't originate in charities in the United States because they have these complicated rules regarding taxing their business income. And so the United States and also the UK have had to create these new legal structures, like L3C companies, public benefit companies, community interest companies, to allow a structure for a not-for-profit entity to carry out business activity, because they've prevented charities from carrying out business activity themselves. So they've had to create even more complexity. And in practice, these alternative structures have also not worked. So it's really important, in my view, to address issues at the level of source rather than symptom. Because what they're concerned about is charities running businesses, big businesses. And that's what they're trying to target. But the way that charities law works is that the charitable sector is so diverse. There are so many different charities pursuing different purposes in different places. And when you try to draw blunt blanket lines targeted at the outliers, it will cause real harm to the vast bulk of charities, which are good charities trying to do good work in the community.
How does, say for example, I'm not sure where Rotary sits in New Zealand, but I do know Rotary has got quite a huge standing in the community here in New Zealand and within the Pacific region, because it's extended its help out in the islands. I come from Fiji, and I've seen Rotary New Zealand do a lot of hospital engagement out in the community. Is that non-related, or what is going to happen to their kind of work? And they do it out of volunteer.
That's a very good question, and I would encourage Rotary to make submissions, to work through how this paper will affect them, and to make submissions, because Chapter 2 focuses on business income, but Chapter 4 also has some issues for has some other suggestions, and one of those relates to what's known as the mutual transactions rules. So it is quite technical, but there is a common law rule that says you can't make a profit from transacting with yourself. So that's known as the principle of mutuality. So the Income Tax Act doesn't tax certain transactions with a not-for-profit entity and its members on the basis that this is you can't tax something from, you can't make a profit from transacting with yourself. Now, this issues paper proposes to remove that, and this will affect approximately 9,000 small community organisations that are not registered charities. So if you have an exemption, this won't apply. But if you don't have an exemption and you do have transactions with your members, then this issues paper, if this proposal goes ahead, could result in the organisation having to pay tax. And if there's a certain threshold where small not-for-profit organisations don't have to file returns, but it's only $1,000. So if they have expenditure above $1,000, then they could now have to file tax returns. It has been criticised in the media as stinging community organisations with larger tax bills for what would not be a great deal of revenue. The key concern I have with this paper is that the proposals would cause large compliance costs for charities, but would raise very little, if any, revenue. Really.
Wow. So it's a tilted scale.
Absolutely. It hasn't been properly thought through, in my view, which is why I'm so concerned that charities do make submissions, because they're moving quickly. They want to get things done by budget. So charities do have this small window to have their voice heard, and I really would encourage them to do that, because otherwise, you know, the Titanic's going to hit the iceberg. Yeah.
Yes. This mutual transaction that you talked about, can you just unpack it a bit for, say, small organisation like us in Tier 4 that is thinking, at the moment we do not get members to pay fee for membership. Would that be taxed? Say if we start getting membership, we open it up, do we get taxed for membership?
Well, it could absolutely do. I mean, I think it would definitely be worth looking more closely at that. I mean, these issues are always complex at an individual level, so it will depend on your particular structure and the nature of the actual transactions. It always depends on the facts. So I wouldn't want to opine in the abstract, if you know what I mean. But yep. I'd be happy to have a look at it, because, you know, I do think, yes, you could potentially, you know, be at risk, yeah.
The new legislation that all those that had collapsed for the 2022 Incorporated Society. And a lot of our people that have charity status didn't really get the charitable number, registration number. They just went through the Incorporated Society. Now the new legislation has come in and they are required to do the charities and do the Incorporated Society together. How is that going to impact? Because we are now moving across to get incorporated for the simple reason we would like to pay our broadcasters because we have radio shows around some other region. How would that impact us? Because we're small. We don't earn any income.
Yeah. Well, that is a whole different kettle of fish. But if the first question is to work out what structure you are now, what legal structure you are now. And in practice, I understand that there is a lot of confusion about that. And so the first question, whether or not the Act applies and how it might apply will depend on what structure you are. So the first question is, are you a trust or are you an incorporated society? So if you're a trust, the Incorporated Societies Act doesn't apply to you. But if you're an incorporated society, the question then is, which act are you incorporated under? So it used to be possible to incorporate as a society under the Charitable Trusts Act. So the Charitable Trusts Act had two pathways. You could incorporate as a trust or incorporate as a society. Now that option has been removed. You can no longer incorporate as a society under the Charitable Trusts Act. But if you were incorporated as a society under the Charitable Trusts Act, you can, if you wish, migrate to the new Incorporated Societies Act 2022, but you are not required to. So there's a lot of confusion about entities incorporated under the Charitable Trust Act because the company's office doesn't differentiate, calls them all charitable trust boards, even though some of them are actually societies. So that's one big area of confusion. But if you're incorporated under the Incorporated Societies Act 1908, which is what's known as an incorporated society, mm-hmm. then this new 2022 Act applies to you,
okay.
And you must take action. Because if you don't take action before 5 April next year, which is only, you know, just over a year away, then you will cease to exist as an incorporated society, which means you will have no automatic right to your assets. The assets of the society will fall to be dealt with by the Registrar of Incorporated Societies under the 2022 Act. And you will also have no protection of incorporation. So any contracts or leases or staff or whatever, it will no longer be held in the name of the society. It will be held in the individual names of members or officers of the society. So they will face personal liability. So it is a cliff. 5 April 2026 is a cliff. And actually that's Easter Sunday, I understand. So you might want to, it's important to have things in place lower. 5 April 2026. Because the thing about incorporated societies is that they are democratic organisations. So they are run by their members through general meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So the membership must decide how they want to respond to this legislation. There's a number of options. The main one is to re-register. If they want to re-register, they're going to have to get a constitution that's compliant with the new legislation, and they're going to have to set up processes to deal with some of the new requirements of the legislation, and then they must actively re-register. And because you have to have general meetings and because the constitution, people might have comments on it and you might need, you know, to have a bit of iteration, then, you know, you need to allow time for that.
Mm-hmm.
And once the constitution has been approved, then you need to hold a general meeting under your own rules.
Mm-hmm.
To adopt the constitution and to re-register. So that can all take some time.
Yeah.
Another option, some incorporated societies are choosing to restructure, perhaps as a charitable trust. Some of them are choosing to wind up. There are a lot, if you look at the Gazette notices on the company's office website, a lot of incorporated societies, particularly sporting ones, are winding up. Which I find quite confronting. You know, there is concern that it's become so complex we're just pushing grassroots organisations.
Wow.
I'm concerned about that. Those are the three main options. I mean, for each organisation, they have to make the decision that's best for them, and that decision has to be made by members. So, you know, if that process hasn't begun, I would strongly recommend that it gets started as soon as possible, because you don't want to miss that deadline.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the information that you've given us. As lay people, these are real mountains for us.
I completely understand. And you know, charities and incorporated societies are dealing with the Incorporated Societies Act 2022. And then on top of that, they bring in this whole issues paper with all these tax changes that with a very short period for charities to get their heads around. So, you know, it's a pretty tough climate out there. I am very concerned about the impact on charities.
I think you've really covered a lot for those of us that are new in this taxation within the charity space. Can you just unpack unincorporated? Where do they stand here? Because I do know there are some businesses or they sit as unincorporated society and yet present themselves as charitable, but they are businesses. Yes.
You can be unincorporated. It's very common for a charity to start off as a group of people who just come together for a shared purpose. It's very common. So, and the Charities Act accommodates that. So you can be an unincorporated body and still seek charitable registration. You have to have a set of rules. You have to meet all the requirements, but you don't have to be incorporated. But the risks inherent in operating on an unincorporated basis are significant because you don't have the protection of incorporation. So members and officers effectively are personally liable. So any contract has to be in the name of individuals rather than in the name of the corporate body. So as soon as a charity starts growing and owning assets or wanting to enter into contracts, I would strongly recommend that they do seek some form of incorporation. To get that protection.
Yeah, because I do know of one that sort of comes under, I think they call it, what do they call the city centre? They have this business commerce section within
Chamber of Commerce,
yeah. And I've been to a few of their meetings, and they're quite wealthy, but unincorporated.
Well, I would recommend that they, you know, because that means that people are standing in their personal names, and if they own any property in particular, every time somebody leaves, then they're going to have to change the ownership at the land registry office, or whatever it's called, you know, because it's not owned in the name of a body corporate, it's owned in the names of individuals. So, you know, I mean, I'm sure they've probably had this advice before. So.
There's a lot of professional individuals in there. I think they're the ones propping up the organization. They're probably like lawyers, accountants. So probably, and I see it and I'm going, oh, wow. But then with this new legislation and the new taxation that's coming in, I wonder where they stand.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, are they an unincorporated society? I mean, are they paying tax? Do they have transactions with their members that they are considering to be non-taxable? If so, this issues paper might change that. So I would encourage them to get engaged as well.
Yeah. I was a member and I was paying like $150 a year and I'm going, no more. I'm out. but in saying that, is there any last words you want to share with us? This is episode one, please, Miss Baka. Episode one, may we have another one nearer to the time just to shake people up so that they can go out and do what's right for their organizations?
Very happy. Yes, always happy to talk about these issues.
Yeah, because it's quite, I know I'm going to listen to our talk and go, oh my gosh, you know, we're right in the middle of preparing our annual return now. That time of the year. Then this you need to take on board.
I know. Well, that's another concern I have, because the 31st of March is the end of the financial year for many, many charities and other organisations. So that makes it doubly difficult for charities to engage properly. You know, I agree. The timing is very difficult.
Do you have any final thought? It's a lot. Right now it's like a big, huge iceberg, you've uncovered to us. Is there any final word you want to give out to the charitable, the smaller ones and the big ones that are out there to just be mindful of?
Well, the main thing I think at the moment, the current requirement, please do engage with this issues paper and Make Your Voice Heard before 31st of March, which is Monday week. We've got a week.
We've got a week. Do you mind if I send it out to anyone that requests?
No, at all. No, happy.
Okay. Okay. Vinaka Vaka Levu, thank you so much. Tēnā koe, ngā mihi nui. And I wish you well. And like I said, this is episode one, and we will continue this dialogue when you wish to go on air again. And we will be airing this right throughout all our Radio VT shows, other parts of New
Zealand. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you. Nisa Mwademanda. Thank you. Bye. Bye. Aroha ki te atua, aroha ki a maria, ki te rangi te whenua, ake tonu, ake tonu. Enda na ngole sarakiviti, kanda rongoda endo na itutuku karto katona na ABC News mai Australia, kanda rongoda tuki na nandomona endo verto nandauni wala tutuku ka ngone leoni viti ko lide mobono. Membalata tinga na kena wakayanga taki na Bluetoothing, sena nonrabi wasaitiko na idhula keinanra, mera bakan dewa dewa na waini mateninga nga sa duru miratu na duru bola lai serongone leo karabi soli soli ti o ka mai baka buna sarati ki na natumbu ni mateongo na HIV AIDS mai na nonda buna lomani eviti da sana rongot sar na katkatonio.
It's a Friday morning in Fiji's capital, Suva. Volunteers are handing out t-shirts. 3XL. The government is launching a condom campaign in a bid to encourage people to practice safe sex.
As someone who has been living with the virus, I'm so grateful this morning that it's really happened.
It's a small step toward addressing a growing crisis, an outbreak of HIV.
It's a virus many thought was under control, but Fiji is in the midst of an unprecedented surge in positive cases. What is fueling this rise in HIV, and what can be done to stop it before it's too late?
In January this year, Fiji's health minister officially declared a HIV outbreak.
Before we will see a reduction in the number of cases, Fiji will see a rise in the number of cases.
More than 1,000 HIV cases were detected last year. That's three times more than the number in 2023, and a nine-fold increase from the 120 infections recorded in 2019. It's the second fastest growing HIV epidemic in the Asia-Pacific region.
Thank you so much.
Quite a few of our doctors have raised the issue that HIV is on the increase, and they've been yelling and doesn't seem to be much happening.
Dr. Alipati Vakamuthea is the president of the Fijian Medical Association.
This particular surge, the outbreak, has been driven by the IV drug users.
He says as many as 50% of new cases are from intravenous drugs use, with the country's only psychiatric hospital, St. Giles, overwhelmed by users.
St. Giles is getting swamped with addicts. And the interesting thing here is the age group. It's really young. I think they've had like somebody in primary school that's already defined addict.
He says the system is missing many positive cases. 90 newborns were born with HIV last year. All transmissions that can be avoided if detected.
That means your system has failed. It's collapsed.
Children, like, they're having an injection here, this place.
On the streets of Suva, syringes loaded with methamphetamine sell for as little as $7. Another alarming trend is the practice of Bluetoothing.
That's where somebody injects methamphetamines. It takes their blood and injects it into themselves. So it's a way of sort of sharing the drug to make it go further.
As Fiji's two major health crises become intertwined, it's adding strain to an already overwhelmed system. This is one of just three sexual health clinics in Fiji where people with HIV can come for treatment.
A lot of the drug users who have contracted HIV through intravenous drug use are getting picked up here.
Fiji's Health Minister, Dr. Ratu Antonio Lalambalavu, has announced a 90-day plan to tackle the surge, focusing on acquiring more medications, prevention, and increased testing.
It's not so. We have a lot of catching up, a lot of things to improve on, and that is part of the 90-day plan.
While messaging is now more visible, experts say the ministry is playing catch-up.
The HIV response is at least about 15 years lagging behind. We don't have some of the prevention, like a PrEP available in the country. We don't have needle syringe programs. Testing is still limited.
With the help of the finance minister.
But Fiji's health minister defends his handling of the crisis, saying funding for HIV services had been in decline for over a decade.
Since entering office, I was told about the numbers back then, and immediately, you know, it was a no-brainer. It was one of the first messages that I said in Parliament about the HIV crisis.
He says there are other challenges too.
Why are people coming in for testing and they do not want to know the results? They come in for testing with a false name or false contact number, and that they're going away. And when it's positive, it's lost to follow.
As many as half of HIV-positive people in Fiji are not receiving treatment.
HIV is a treatable disease. We have treatment available. It is free. Even if you are positive, it is not a death sentence.
Mark Lal, who tested positive to HIV last year, has watched three of his friends die because they were diagnosed too late.
Thank you so much for meeting me.
They started to lose a lot of weight. There were so many symptoms going on. Organs were failing. So their death, for me, was eye-opening.
While Mark is now receiving treatment, his journey has not been easy.
When I found out and I isolated myself, it felt like the ground had opened and I fell in. And I fell in, it just closed on me.
Mark went public with his diagnosis in December.
I got disowned by my family when I came out publicly. Because my dad comes from a very strict Indian background, I think there was a form of embarrassment when it was in the papers. But I know my family so well, and I know and I hope that they'll come around someday. People are having sex, and not just sex, they're having so much sex. And no one actually even talks about it.
But maybe that's starting to change.
We are looking at 63 condom dispensers sites, and we are asking the public to access these sites.
But unless the drugs crisis is addressed, it's likely HIV cases will continue to rise. There are things the government can start doing right away.
There are strategies that we've seen that have been implemented overseas, like the needle exchange program, or just allowing needles and syringes to be available to this high-risk group.
The outbreak here also comes with a warning for the rest of the Pacific. Despite the challenges, Fiji's health system is among the best in the region. Experts warn that other Pacific nations could be experiencing a surge that is yet to be detected.
Our Pacific Island neighbours would definitely have to take a page out of our book and start setting up those systems. Otherwise, they're going to get a shock when they start to get really, really unusual infections that come out of HIV and AIDS that they have no idea how to address.
Ruth Israel, Grant Patrick Wilson, Saki, Ilisoni Lesu ke Naomi, na music director ko Thomasi Namborisi, ka Norto Dauni Bakatangi Isaac Bainivalu. To talk about na sereni masuya, samaidapa ikena nongu vengara vivekem ni meadoba na madha o katu mai na gai verungo di ndoma talikina ni te imo te tokumanda o ngō ngāna nomi ni ndoni vengara vi ena posa waka viti Elizabethi samanunu wangani vala menda maroro e tiko na nonda vosa waka viti kasulia subaya ni veira na isulisuli o ira na gai muri mai ni te imo te tokumanda.
Bye.